Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. People who crave space, freedom, adventure, and opportunities have long been attracted to Alaska. In July of 1996, I spoke with Milo Kopanen, who grew up in New York City, the son of Finnish immigrants, and who moved to a mountain ridge near Fairbanks, Alaska in 1952. At that time, land there was still open for homesteading. He located his 160 acres and filed a homestead on the ridge where he still lives. After several years there, in the mid-1950s, he returned to the lower 48 states to earn a PhD. Yet the magnet of Alaska pulled him back, where he became a university professor and a member of the Alaskan legislature. He's been there ever since. I met with Milo Kopanen in his kitchen and asked him about the dream that originally drew him north to Alaska.
There was this sort of tendency. My parents, even in the Depression, got a small piece out in the country so they could build a sauna, and all their friends helped put the sauna together. The wood came from another friend of theirs who was had a little mortuary business, all the stone being delivered from Vermont in wooden crates. Mm-hmm. So they just sawed up the wooden crates and built a sauna out of them.
And this was in New York City?
Yeah. And partly when I was very small, we lived on my mother's uncle's farm in Trumansburg in the Finger Lakes country and all that. I used to love to just take off. My parents trusted me. I'd go into the woods and, you know, take for half a day or longer. That's the way I grew up.
And then there was something about Alaska that was a magnet?
No. Not then. I wasn't even thinking about Alaska. Of course, I read all the stories. I read a lot of different things. I did go to Finland with the American Friends Service Committee in 1948, and the Karelians, 400,000 of them, had left Karelia when the Russians took over. 90% of Finland in those days was forest and rural country, and they were essentially homesteaded, and we were helping build clear land and build cabins in eastern Finland. Well, that was a very seminal experience, you know, the work camp as a collective community dedicated to work, but also just the lifestyle there. So that made a big impression on me.
And at that time, you were about 21.
20. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 48 and just 20 years old. And I came to New York and went to work in the shipyard and also for Church World Service. I wanted eventually to go on to Antioch College. I knew people out there, Ernest and Elizabeth Morgan. I stayed with them in the 46, I think, 45. I was admitted, and then they wanted $600 for tuition. I didn't have $600. And I'd been active in CORE, Committee on Racial Equality, early on. So I went to Wilberforce State College, which is a black college, the first white, so-called white graduate. It was during that period that I started thinking very much of Alaska, and it would sort of just fit it in with everything that I'd done in Finland and what I'd grown up thinking, what it's oriented toward.
You came up here and near Fairbanks in 1951 and applied to homestead 160 acres.
Yeah, well, actually filed on the homestead in 52. We didn't. Mm-hmm. We left the East Coast in 51. We took the opportunity of visiting friends, and that's Large F and Small F, and other members of the Farmers Union, people who were active in co-ops. I'd grown up in a co-op and all the rest of that. And I was very interested in what was then called intentional communities, and we stopped at several of those. So we only got here in about March of 52. We came to Fairbanks because the alumni of Antioch College, there were two families here. One lived in Juneau. In those days, you could not drive to Juneau.
You still can't.
The others were here, the Griffiths. And We stayed with them for a short while and found a number of Finns, people of Finnish ancestry, even friends of my parents here. And they helped us find a place out in the Chattanooga Flats, and we lived out there. And I worked for the mining company as an electrician, which my father had been an electrician. I'd worked in the shipyards in Hoboken with him and a dredge as a ship. Partly, I wanted to go someplace where there weren't so many people and weren't. Levittown was coming up, and subdivisions were going all over the place. And I told people that when I came back from Finland and they'd torn up the streetcars in New York, that broke my last tie with New York.
Mm-hmm. At some point, though, when you were quasi-settled here in Fairbanks, you wanted to go back for further graduate education.
I only wanted to go to graduate school. I wanted to get a degree because I was very interested in education as well as other things. Mm-hmm. And we did try to start a friend's school, but in the 50s we had too few friends, and also we got totally involved with organizing what became the Native Land Claims movement. But my own personal ambitions, at least four of us, in the Friends meeting, got our teacher certificate so we could end up teaching. But rather than being able to start Friends School, we all started teaching in public school.
And you ended up teaching at the University of Alaska.
Well, I taught fifth grade in the public school. Then I was interested in anthropology and linguistics. One of the members of the meeting was a linguist, Gordon Marsh, and an anthropologist. And I was always interested in linguistics from the viewpoint of, you know, historical linguistics, how language changed, and also mm-hmm. how different types of language organized the world for you in different ways. I was very aware of that, you know, growing up speaking Finnish. Finnish, for example, doesn't have gender. I was startlingly aware, I remember, the fact that English organized everything in terms of opposites, you know, black, white, in, out, up, down, man, woman, good, evil, which always struck me as being a very artificial and constricted way of thinking. I mean, it distorted people's thinking, and they were not aware of it. Even as a kid, I was aware of that. But anyway.
Well, talk about some other examples of that. That's interesting, about how other languages organize in different ways, different from the way English does for us.
The agglutinative languages, which Finno-Ugric is one, Turkic, including Mongol, Kalki, including the Eskimoy and Chukchi, Aleut language, and the languages which were based on Ainu. Ainu was much closer to Finno-Ugric than the other languages, which are Korean and Japanese. But one of the interesting things we found here when we gave kids the WISC, the Wechsler intelligence test, that native kids from Inupiaq and Yupik families, where the language is still spoken, by and large, principally boys but also girls, would cool the math test. And actually, it wasn't the numbers that they were good at, but it was the block test, which gives you, you know, different series of blocks, pictures of blocks from one direction, you're supposed to one pick the other.
The spatial organization test.
Spatial organization. And they were always cool at, which seemed rather confusing. But I remember also that growing up in New York, if I went to a place one time, I could go there again by any number of different routes. I mean, mm-hmm. it's sort of the world is organized mm-hmm. Spatially. And for instance, in Finnish, you start out with a word stem and you put suffixes on it. Mm-hmm. There's only about 16 so-called cases in Finnish, 15. They argue about it. Hungarian's got about 26. And most of those refer, you know, this is a cup using a loanword kuppi. Otan kuppi pöydästä, I take it from the table. Panen sen pöydän, on top of the table. Pöydälle, into the table. And, mm-hmm. you know, that the reference are primarily spatial.
Well, do you feel that an ability to locate a place as you mention in your own personal example is language-based, or is it more the kind of intelligence that an individual is born with? Or some of each?
I really don't believe in the nurture-nature argument, because all nature is nurture, extended over a span of time. I think that those languages tend to focus on that, and therefore that ability becomes
more developed.
Is more developed. Mm-hmm. The binary languages, which are all principally Indo-European languages, I think are certainly, they drop this elaborate structure we call logic, which is really nothing but grammar. But it does force people into compartmentalizing things in terms of opposites. It also means organizing, conceptualizing the world in terms of a hierarchy, so Linnaean hierarchy of opposite little boxes, all of which spring up with more and more little boxes. It's very powerful. It makes decision-making very much more rapid and much easier. Not always right. I think the story of Alexander, when he took over the city of Gordias, and the priests invited him into the temple, and here was this elaborate knot, woven knot, which actually is the knot that you see in much ancient iconography, which to me, I think that what they symbolized was the interconnectedness of everything in the world. The priest told Alexander that anyone who could untie this knot could conquer the world. So good old Indo-European logic springs into action. You take that sort of whack. That's not the same thing as untying the knot, though. No. But nevertheless, that's a typical Indo-European way of approaching a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Rapid, got an answer right away.
Yeah,
not necessarily the one that's going to solve all the problems.
I want to take a moment and say that we're talking with Nilo Kopanen in his home, in his kitchen, near Fairbanks, Alaska. You're listening to Radio Curious, and my name is Barry Vogel. This issue of languages intrigues me.
Mm-hmm.
Are you indicating that the languages that the native people in this not necessarily in this part of the world, but native people speak, has a lot to do with the decision-making process and the time and speed?
Definitely. And also the fact, for instance, especially among the Inupiat and Yupik people, that the decision-making process has to be, by and large, collective.
Where do these people live? The Inupiat and
Inupiat are the northern Eskimo along the Arctic Circle and down to the Seward Peninsula. Mm-hmm. Yupik speakers are southern Eskimo, and they live mostly along the Bering Sea. And then, of course, you have related people, the Aleut out in the island and islands, and Konyak or Aleutic and Chukotkanyut. All the way down to, historically they probably went at least as far as Mount St. Elias, because they were the people that Bering initially met. The interior people are Athabascans. They're related to the Navajo. Their language is organized differently, and the society is also... if you have a talk about a kinship system among Eskimo, it would be bilateral. I mean, and interestingly enough, so it is among Finns and so on. Whereas the Athabascan, like Tlingits and others, are matrilineal. Mm-hmm. And their language, it's a little more difficult. It sounds like Pennsylvania Dutch. Instead of using suffixes, they use affixes.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some languages in the Caucasus and Basque. There are only these three separate sort of groups, plus one isolated group in in Siberia called the Ket, Dinget Yet, or Yenisei Ostyaks. I suspect that the Ket, who call themselves Dinget Yet, are really the ancestral people to the Athabascans, because Dene is the general term by which Athabascans speak of people, including themselves, Din or Dinget Yet. And if a group calls themselves Din instead of Den or Dene, that that still shows a relationship.
There's a lot to talk about in the area of language, but I'm also interested in your experiences as a member of the Alaska State Legislature. The goals that you hoped to achieve while you were there.
Well, I don't think I had been involved in politics, you know, on one level or another ever since high school.
Yeah.
So I don't think I had any illusions. At least I can't remember any. I did not think that, you know, that I could reform the world through the state legislature, but I thought it was important to try to support you know, the university, public education, the democratization of society, and opening up the political process to as many people as possible.
What years were you a member of the legislature?
From 19, I was elected in 1982, and I was there 10 years, and I retired in 1990, well, January 93, which completed the term. My wife had been injured in an automobile accident the previous winter, and so I retired to take care of her. I think I was able to accomplish some things, but nothing global. I did try to get the legislature to pass a resolution favoring a nuclear-free Arctic, and Secretary of State Shultz at that time was apparently affronted enough, or had been warned by some of the Republican members, that he sent a personal telegram to every member of the legislature reminding us that in his view, state legislatures had nothing to say about international relationships, that is the business of the State Department. Wow.
Yeah. But even though a nuclear-free issue is very personal about what you do on your own land.
Yeah. Interesting enough, the one who picked it up, of course, was the Soviet premier at the time. I don't think that was the only one, but I did work with some of the Canadians and Greenlanders on the issue.
Well, taking, for example, the way decisions are made in the legislature, it's by a majority vote. That's what prevails, and in some cases it's a two-thirds vote. How do you see the efficacy of that compared with the consensus way of doing things that you mentioned a little while ago?
Well, actually, the way, you know, you have a two-house legislature, actually. You have, for all practical purposes, you have two separate legislatures, the House and the Senate. Any bill that gets introduced also is referred to every pertinent committee, the Finance Committee, you know, regardless. If it's going to cost anything, then it gets referred. If it makes a difference to the action in the if it makes a difference to state statute, it has to be referred to the State Affairs Committee and stuff like that. I was co-chair of the Health and Education Committee for a number of years, and then I got on the Finance Committee because, as I said, almost every bill goes through the Finance Committee. Bills can even be changed in the Rules Committee, and both houses have the rules. So it's not just a simple majority. It means that you have to have a majority in each committee.
Lots of simple majorities.
Yeah. And
so that yields more towards the consensus idea.
Right.
Consensus presuming everyone in accord.
Right. And also, of course, you have to have the agreement of the governor, and who can veto any legislation. The American system, which was constitutionally devised to be a very difficult system to make any changes mm-hmm. in, one of the problems is it becomes so complex and increasingly complex that it becomes very frustrating and also rather boring for the public, and they feel mm-hmm. excluded from the process. Mm-hmm. And therefore they lose interest, and then that it means that you don't necessarily get a representative legislature representing knowledgeable citizens.
And with term limits, you get the staff actually running the issues because they carry the continuity of the history.
That's an important point. And the Senate is also more powerful because they serve a 4-year term and a staggered term. Yeah. So there's always one half the Senate is always going to be there, and they're making deals beforehand on organizing their body. And whereas before the one man, one vote issue came, the Alaska Constitution elected the Senate from the 4 judicial districts. But Congress essentially required single-member districts, and the single-member districts for Senate mean 2 House districts. Well, they're very small. You know, you have at most 30 to 40,000 people mm-hmm. residing in a Senate district.
Yeah,
and so. Given that they are going to have a continuity, they also become very interested in pork barrel issues for their limited
funds for their constituents.
Right. Yeah. So the result is that the Senate really in this state, and I presume in many states that similarly organized, no longer take a broader view. Whereas the original intent of the state constitution, at least, was to make the Senate more broadly representative of the citizens of the state. When we had the Constitutional Convention, which I helped organize but was defeated in running for, one of the things that I got in there was that not only were the 55 members of the Constitutional Convention sitting in a unit, in a single unicameral body, but they were elected some from small localities, some from the judicial districts, and the mm-hmm. the final third of them elected statewide, so that you had people who represented different right. kinds of constituencies.
We don't have much time left, but before we close, I want to ask you about the Native land claims movement and the successes and defeats they've had in the past couple of years.
Well, actually, it began the modern land claims movement. There was a movement in southeastern Alaska, which William Paul was in. They were suing for the value of the land taken from them, and actually the lawsuit in the 50s was for $7 million only. Mm-hmm. But Judge Wickersham in 1912 had called the Tananaw chiefs together and told them to start applying for Native claims under the Allotment Act. And Wickersham was a progressive Republican, a Teddy Roosevelt type. And with the Harding administration, that stopped and nothing happened. In 1955, after the Constitutional Convention, a group of us were meeting in a political convention when 3 members of the Otonaw Copper River Native group came and asked for our help in getting their land back, which they'd let the military use during the war. That got us involved, primarily Quakers. We invited the Indian Rights Association, Ted Hetzel, to come up here. He looked at the situation and said we need the help of the American Association on Indian Affairs. Parenthetically, my wife's uncle, was on the board of directors. Mm-hmm. He came up here. And he financed the founding of the Tundra Times. We call the second Tanawha Chiefs Conference. So the beginning of the Native Land Claims real movement was here in Fairbanks, Interior Alaska, in the late 50s, and mixed Native and so-called white groups, principally pushed by political dissidents and Quakers.
Well, we're about the end of our time. I want to ask you the question I ask all of my guests at the end of an interview, and that is, could you tell us of an interesting book that you've read lately?
That I've read lately? My gosh, I really... Right now, I'm... One interesting book, gracious. I'm afraid I read so many of them and find them all interesting that I can't really tell you. Actually, I'm looking forward to the book biography of Ernest Morgan, son of the Morgan who was the head of TVA. I knew the Morgans in Yellow Springs, Ohio. They were involved with progressive politics and the Friends meeting and worker-controlled industry, Antioch Book Plate Company, and things like that. And to me, they were, in many ways, my mentors. And Ernest is now 92 years old. They had started a school up in the mountains of North Carolina at CELO, the Arthur Morgan School, after his father.
And that's the biography of Ernest Morgan?
Ernest Morgan and the life of Elizabeth Morgan, his wife.
Well, Nilo Kopanen, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious.
Oh, enjoyed it.
Nilo Kopanen is a native of New York City, the son of Finnish immigrants who moved to Fairbanks, Alaska in 1952. He became a university professor and a member of the Alaskan legislature. The book that Nilo Kopanen recommends is The Life Story of Elizabeth Morgan by Ernest Morgan. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.